Today's program has been brought to you by 360 Cookware. Their stainless steel cookware uses vapor technology to cook better tasting, more nutritional food. To learn more and receive 20% off, click their logo on our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Did you ever think about the evolution of the American beverage industry? We'll be drinking history today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, here on heritageradionetwork.org. And I just wanted to remind all of our listeners that Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported and donor-sponsored radio network. So in order to keep all of our programs going, and we hope that you enjoy them and want to keep them going, go to the homepage and click on Donate. Any amount will help, and we appreciate your support. Well, the American beverage industry is, you know, I never really stopped to think about it. It's, you think about from water to whiskey and Kool-Aid to Red Bull. Americans have been industrializing drinks for as long as one can imagine. And, of course, somebody else picked up on that as well, someone who writes a lot about American food history, and that's Andrew F. Smith. Andy teaches food history at the New School in New York City, and he is an engaging educator as well as a generous educator, sharing his knowledge and discoveries with authors, other authors in radio and TV. You've probably seen him on a lot of the TV food history shows. He's the founder of the Edible Series Talks at the Roger Smith Hotel and the Food Writers Conference and the Cookbook Conference here in New York City, which is now in its second year, and it's about to take place in February. Andy is the author or editor of 23 books and counting, as he's shaking his head. His newest book, which I am very excited to talk about today, is called Drinking History. And you can say drinking history or drinking history. It's all about beverages, any way you look at it. And welcome, Andy. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
This, I see, as we talked a little bit before the show, is such a natural companion to your eating history, which came out a couple years ago.
It really started off as three chapters in eating history, and I ended up with 33 chapters, and I decided 30 sounded better than, and really that there were other beverages that histories that I needed to incorporate in. So I decided to remove those three chapters on beverages and put it into a companion volume. So this now is the companion volume to eating history.
It really is true. I mentioned to Andy before this at the top of the show that I really enjoyed how this reads. It flows. You know, Andy, I think it's the chronology of the book. It flows in such a sensible chronological pattern.
I loved writing it, and it was a great, I had to sample everything I was writing about.
Oh, okay.
And that's, of course, a tax deduction, so it worked out very nicely.
And did you have to go through Prohibition as well?
I've been there. done that, so yeah.
Well, I have to say that, yeah. Initially, the title was a little misleading to me, Drinking History.
Do you think it was alcoholic? Everybody does, yeah.
Yeah, really. Drinking History, it just sort of... It brought up thoughts of, you know, history of cocktails or something, yeah. You know, and then all of a sudden I open it and I start to read and I go, oh.
That's one of the reasons why I really wanted to write this book, because everybody thinks of drinking and think alcoholic, but and when there are really wonderful books on coffee and really wonderful books on the history of beer and history of wine, but no book ever pulls them all together, and to me they're all interrelated and they're interconnected, and that's what I tried to get at in Drinking History.
Well, and this, you keep it to... American drinking history, starting with the colonialization of
that's correct.
You know, America. That's the colonial period. But we can back up, and you do give a little background. I mean, first of all, we know that human beings evolved and settled and formed cities around water because we need water.
Well, I only started 400 million years ago. So, and life begins in water. It is so obvious, and I never thought about it before until I started thinking about the importance of water. But all life forms that we know of have water in them. And humans, of course, are 55 to 75% water, which I guess I knew, but I'd never really put into perspective. And we need to replace that water every 3 days. And if we don't take in water every 3 days, we die. So water is even more important in a way than food. Food you can survive for weeks, but water you need immediately. So the question is, how do human beings drink water? And there are thousands of ways that human beings, including Americans, have decided to flavor their water. And to me, I thought that was an interesting story. And I wanted to begin at the beginning, but then focus on America.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you did mention that people for millennia have been flavoring the waters, as you say.
Yes.
What? How?
Bark, leaves, roots. I mean, you name it. There is no group that just drank straight water. If they could add a flavoring to it, they did. And so whatever they would be interested in consuming, they did. So if they consume fish, they would consume it with water. Well, it ends up kind of a soup. But in the end, they consume water. So there are lots of ways in which we consume that.
Well, I was really, my eyes were opened when I was reading some history years ago about colonial period, pre-colonial period, and how everyone drank some form of alcoholic beverage. I mean, it just happened, you know, a fermented thing, even children. But take us through a little bit about how from water and onward.
That was a surprise, too, for me, because America had tremendous resources for water, particularly in New England and the Middle States. In the South, there were problems on water, but as a whole, they had really great water. And so the question was, why did they immediately give up the water, which was the excuse, at least in England, of having bad water and therefore needing to add alcohol to it in order to make it more antiseptic so that it would be more healthy. But that wasn't the need here at all. But people immediately, as soon as they could make alcohol, they did. And they made it in every way that you can think of, in every product that you can think of. So whatever was available, they made it. So if you had a spruce tree, you made spruce beer out of it. If you had corn, you made corn liquor. I mean, a thousand different ways that you could make it. So it really started off as Europeans coming in wanting to duplicate what beverages they consumed in Europe. And for English and for Dutch, for instance, it was beer. And and barley was one of the first introductions into the colonial America, as well as hops. And for whatever reason, simply due to whether the hops were not the right variety, or the barley didn't work out, or whether they didn't have the professionalization that you needed. But the problem was the beer did not work in the New World, and every description of it from local to visitors coming in saying it really tasted bad. So they really needed to flow to other alcoholic beverages. And cider, which I had expected, but I didn't realize how important that was in colonial period of time, applejack and so many other products, particularly in New England and the Middle States, but also in the Southern states, because it would be shipped from New England elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So you had a wide variety of other products. You had persimmon beer, and you had, I mean, you name the product, they would add flavorings to it and try to come up with something alcoholic.
Now, a lot of people will say, well, that's because the sanitation system was not well worked out, but they went to alcohol even before they had problems with dirty water.
Particularly in New England, there was not a problem at all in colonial times or even early Federalist period for water resources. They were just tremendous, and they were available everywhere. I mean, you had flowing streams all over the place. In the South, particularly in the tidewater areas, you did have problems with water, and so they had a little more justification for going to alcoholic beverages. But then even there, if you start looking at it, what surprised me about the colonial period, and I've written on the colonial period, I've studied the colonial period, I've taught the colonial period, was the diversity of alcoholic beverages that were there. I mean, you know, people drank from the time that they got up in the morning until the time that they went to bed, and it wasn't just males doing that. It was also females, and it was also children.
Children, that surprised me. All right.
And, I mean, all the descriptions were that children from the earliest days on would be given cider kin, which is a lighter alcoholic version of hard cider, and it was a surprise to me. I hadn't expected that, but the American alcoholic consumption actually increases until 1830. 1830 is the largest amount of alcohol consumed on a per capita basis in America, including today. So people think that today we're drinking a lot of alcohol, and the answer is not as much as we would have not as much as you would have in earlier American times.
No, today if you drink it for breakfast, you're suspect. But those days, they would have it even at breakfast.
They had eye-openers. I mean, and then the names of the products, many of which we don't really know the total contents for, but I counted about 3,000 or 4,000 names of products like eye-opener, fog cutter. I mean, all these names that people at least created for consuming a beverage. And they considered this medicinal, incidentally. So I just want you to know, I too have considered it medicinal on occasion, but not every morning.
What I did, the title of the book, I did not give the full title because it's Drinking History, and then it is 15 turning points in the making of American beverages. Now, these turning points, you narrowed it down to 15. I don't know how you kept it at 15, but that was...
There were some that I debated very, very clearly, and some that I regretted. I knew I needed to do something, but couldn't find the right event to describe it. So today, for instance, the most commonly consumed spirit happens to be vodka. I mentioned vodka in there, I have a section on it, but I never figured out the right turning point to say where did America... No American consumed vodka in the United States prior to 1933, and even then it was a very minor beverage, and yet it explodes after that.
So. Well, you know, I think gin's back on the uptake, so, you know, don't worry about it.
Well, all of the, they all go through phases, and of course, you know, the gin houses of early colonial America were what set off the Puritan clergy to begin with about being really upset and creating first the temperance movement and then prohibition.
Well, without being a spoiler and giving away, you know, everything in the book, I want you to take us through some of those 15 points, but briefly, you know, touch on. The first, we have the colonial diversity. Okay,
I started with that because I thought that was really where America begins in its beverage history. I mean, it's this huge diversity of beverages. And then from there, one of the first introductions happens to be rum, which I guess from my grade school American history class, I remembered rum and slavery and all that sort of thing. But I never realized how important rum was to the American Revolution. And that connection I hadn't made until I started writing the section. But obviously, New Englanders didn't have the soil like you did in the South or like you did in the middle colonies to have an agricultural system that would financially be viable. So they had to shift to other things, and so some of them went into seafaring, and some went into logging, but others went into making rum, and so they got it from the Caribbean. And the control that the plantation owners in Barbados and in other British colonies had over the British Parliament was something that I was generally aware of, but didn't realize how important that was. As soon as they required that all American, North Americans had to buy their molasses from the British Isles, then their price went dramatically up. And so you had French colonies there, and France declined to permit rum making or importation into France because of the wine industry that's there. So you have all of these French colonies that are producing sugar, and they got this molasses all over the place, and they're just dumping it into the ocean. And so really cheap. And so Americans started going in and getting this cheap molasses illegally, and the smuggling starts off in 1730, and it continues for almost 30 years. And it's only when the British try to impose enforcement on it that then the colonies become very upset about this. So
you give explanation for a lot of those phrases that we've heard for years, like
taxation without representation.
Taxation without representation.
It was really smuggling without taxation was what the primary principle was. But that doesn't sound good. You can't start a revolution with it, and you certainly can't put that in an elementary textbook. So that's not what we learned. But that is the major cause of the friction that begins between England and the United States after the French and Indian War.
And Romanism and rebellion. Well, we get the Roman rebellion.
That will be later on. But the fascinating thing at that point is Americans weren't drinking rum at that point. Hmm. So it was just this nice alliteration that a minister got up that says, oh, yeah, let's add all these things together. And it will end in the election of a Democratic president. So after the American Civil War, that in itself created enough anger among Italians and other Catholics that have immigrated into America.
So we go through rum playing an important role in our independence, and then on to the tea parties and tea. We were still very much a tea-drinking society.
Yes, coffee was there, but it simply wasn't an important part of American society. And the tea, a surprise for me, was relatively simple. It was a female beverage from the beginning, and in many ways, still is. There's certainly lots of males that drink tea, and females that drink coffee, but there was this division, and women could get together over a tea clatch, and they could talk to each other, and this was the equivalent of men going into the tavern or later to the saloon. So men had a social place to meet and talk, and women did too, and it was virtually over tea. Mm-hmm. So you had this whole tea movement that will begin, that will start, of course, in colonial America, and then you have this big evidence of tea being thrown into the harbor in Boston, which gets all the news, but also in six other colonial cities, you had similar types of events that happened. And they never got the news because they weren't the first one. And the British punished the Bostonians, not the New Yorkers, who also threw tea into the New York Harbor. Hmm. So I thought that was interesting. So tea, in the end, sounds a lot better to have a revolution about or taxation than it does to have rum and slavery and molasses and that sort of thing. So so that's part of what leads to the American Revolution. But then another surprise to me was, beginning in the 1820s and 1830s, we had medical professionals that were arguing against the consumption of tea and coffee because of this caffeine in it. It was a drug, and it was horrible. And in a sense, that trend has remained with us.
It comes and goes.
It comes and goes. Yeah. And those perennial things, it's so surprising to me how frequently in historical times you have that come up as an argument, then it fades away, then it comes back again.
Hmm. And we get back to the hard drinks again. Cider, we have this big boom in cider again before.
And then cider disappears, and hard cider does. And my question was, why was that the case? In part, it was you had cheaper, more alcoholic beverages like rum come on, and then whiskey. And of course, as soon as whiskey hits America, rum phases out, simply because you don't have to port molasses from the Caribbean. You can make it here with virtually anything. It
gives more importance to Johnny Appleseed, right?
Well, Johnny Appleseed's an interesting person who is, of course, a teetotaler. I mean, he doesn't believe in alcoholic consumption at all. But here he is planting apple trees. And the only reason why anyone would plant the apple trees that he did would be to make apple cider, because the apples that were coming out of those trees were not consumable. They were very bitter, and they were very small, and they were not something that you would want to bite. They're not a delicious apple that you would like to bite into. So really, he in many ways promoted hard cider production, particularly in the Midwest, by his actions.
Well, kind of skipped over a step there, and right before we go to break, I want to hear a little bit about that, and that's, you give an interesting name to something we all know well. You call tarantula juice.
Oh, I love tarantula juice. Wouldn't you ever think of having a little tarantula juice with a little whiskey in it? I mean, come on, that would really make a zinger at the end.
Tell us where this comes from.
Well, it's a Western saloon product that comes online and that everybody falls in love with the name tarantula juice. Oh, that sounds horrible.
Dangerous.
Yeah. And let's give it a shot, you know. And so, but all those names. I started to collect names of just cocktails and beverage combinations on it. I stopped at about 15,000. It was a small number compared to what number is out there. I ask a few of those who write extensively about the history of cocktails, how many cocktails are there really? And they said, well, we only know of about 50,000, but there's lots of ones we don't know about.
So, oh, my goodness.
So you look at these, whether they're really different or not is another issue, but each each saloon or bartender would create their own products, and their goal in life was not to tell anybody what they consisted of, simply because somebody else could make it then. Yeah. So they were really trade secrets, and that was another, I should have expected that, but each bartender would have their own formula to make things, and they wouldn't really pass it on to other people. And that all changes in 1861 when you begin to have a publication of bartenders with books about trying to stabilize.
On comes Jerry Thomas. Right.
And Jerry Thomas comes on, and then you have products that become, the definition for them then becomes relatively clear, because once you've got it in writing, then people can say, well, a martini's got to include gin, and it's got to include vermouth, or it doesn't, depending on how you define it.
Well, whiskey, cider, and then they start to perfect growing the hops and making beer. We're going to hear more about a lot of these beverages when we come back from our break.
You're listening to Home of Emptiness by Pamela Royal on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by AmeriCraft. AmeriCraft and 360 Cookware are proud sponsors of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. AmeriCraft is an American company, and like Heritage Radio Network, they provide the best. Their 360 Cookware is made of the highest quality ingredients, like United States steel. It is made in the greenest cookware manufacturing plant in the world. AmeriCraft makes great cookware and is focused on improvement. 360 Cookware is their exclusive line. It's a contemporary line of cookware and bakeware intended to let you, the Heritage Radio Network listeners, have a unique cooking experience. Its vapor seal allows food to be cooked in its natural juices, preserving all of the vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients without added water, oils, or fats. 360 Cookware invites you to learn more about how this process works on their website, www.360cookware.com. Every Wednesday at noon, Dorothy Cann Hamilton, founder and CEO of the International Culinary Center, interviews the top chefs in the world on Chef Story. Hear from chefs like Christina Tosi.
I'm going to be the best pastry cook this restaurant's ever seen.
Frances Malman.
Cooking with fire, it's very feminine, it's very fragile.
And Jacques Pepin.
I was invited to work at the White House for John Kennedy.
Learn how the greats become great every Wednesday at 12 p.m. on Chef Story. HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, welcome back to A Taste of the Past. I'm sitting here with my friend Andy Smith talking about drinking, but drinking in America through history, drinking a little bit of everything, according to this book. Andy, you cover the period of time from the colonial period up through the present. What is there something in your research that really surprised you about the beverage industry or drinks and America's habits?
I've written about beverages before, but I must admit there is no chapter that didn't surprise me about something I had not expected and that I was absolutely fascinated by, which is one of the reasons why you can continue writing if you're fascinated by something. How did this happen? I think I was most fascinated by Prohibition, the period of time. Of course, I saw Elliot Ness on television, and I know about Al Capone, and I know about all the people fighting each other and doing all the murders and things of that sort. But I wasn't aware of how important Prohibition was in cities in particular. And I didn't realize that it was a product of the progressive movement. And the progressive movement will start off and will argue for end of slavery. It will argue for women's rights and women's suffrage. It will argue for direct election of senators. It will argue for the income tax, believe it or not, all because they're also supporting prohibition. And at that time, alcoholic beverages provided more than 50% of the federal budget was excise taxes on alcohol. So in order to, if you get rid of the you have to have a source of income, and so income tax is one of the things that they argue for. But they're also arguing for, in this case, prohibition. And that surprised me. I never associated that with the pure food movement, with all the other progressive movements that were going along. So it's really an association. These groups were very in favor of women voting, incidentally, because they knew that if women voted, they would vote out alcohol. And so you look at these connections on this, and you say, that's fascinating. So I think that was a part of the interest in it, how it came about. It was the first successful group of a single interest group that lines together and says, this is the only criteria that we are going to use about whether we're going to support a candidate or not. Reminds me very much of, mm-hmm. of the Tea Party mm-hmm. today.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to bring that up.
That doesn't really, in theory, doesn't really care whether you're Democrat or Republican. Only if you support this way, if you agree with them, then they will support you. And if you don't agree with them, they will oppose you. And so that is exactly what the movement did, and it was extremely successful. And I think that was another surprise, how a single interest group could not just pass legislation in cities and in counties and in states and in the federal government, but actually get an amendment passed to the U.S. Constitution, something that was very rare prior to the time that you have the passage of the 18th Amendment.
I have to say, struck me as well. And also about the prohibition movement and the passing of the Volstead Act, what surprised me was how this all coincided with our initial involvement in the First World War.
Yes, and I guess that was another part to this. I did not expect that this was really an outcome of World War One, in which case you had two things. You had German brewers, for instance, who, and many of them at the beginning of the war, 1914, when the United States was not in the war, supported Germany. And so you had a lot of them moving. And when the United States enters the war in 1917, now they're declared enemies. And even though they no longer supported Germany after the United States entered the war, it's still this patriotic fervor that's there. And in part of that, you needed to preserve wheat in order to be able to supply our 1 million man army plus
feed
our
the
allies.
Troops. Yeah.
And that means you have much less wheat grain available for producing hard liquor, so you pass during the war, the federal government stopped permitting alcohol to be produced except for medicinal and industrial purposes. So they really had stopped alcohol consumption at that point. And likewise, they started on beer and tried to lower the alcoholic content of beer in order to increase it. So these things are happening well before the Volstead Act and well before the 18th Amendment. So,
well, weren't some, during Prohibition, weren't some immigrant groups allowed a certain allotment of their beer or wine?
During Prohibition, certain religious groups were allowed certain beverages, and that was another surprise when it gets into Prohibition. So if you were Jewish, it was okay to have a little wine for religious purposes only. So a large number of people, including a large number of African Americans, became Jewish and were therefore drinking medicinal wine holy wine on particular numerous occasions. I'll phrase it that way. And likewise, the Catholics were permitted wine because of the Mass and because of religious ceremonies and things of that sort. So you really had permission to consume wine under certain circumstances. So America became very holy during Prohibition, and that's part of it. And by the way, also, you could have if you're a doctor or a medical professional, you could issue a permit to have a patient consume alcohol. So people got a lot of good visibility to their doctors and got lots of permits to do this. And then, of course, industrial alcohol was permitted. And so you have massive increases in industrial alcohol, although the uses weren't there, but then it would be siphoned off into speakeasies and things of that sort.
Kind of like here we are, come full circle again, we have medicinal marijuana and, you know, and the fight to legalize that. And, you know, and so it's I mean, interesting how history repeats itself.
Well, I thought that was an interesting connection, but I didn't make that in the book. But
no, I brought that up. I take full credit for that one.
But on the beverage side to it, what was incredible was New York taking example. New Yorkers never believed that Prohibition was for them. And the upper class drank from the beginning to the end. These are the upper classes were the ones that strongly supported Prohibition because they believed it was for the lower classes who were drinking too much. And so the only people who really suffered in New York City, for instance, were those who drank beer. It happened to be Germans because you couldn't easily brew beer. You could easily make bathtub gin anywhere, but it is not easy to brew beer. So beer consumption literally dies during Prohibition, and the breweries either go out of business or they convert to making near beer or other commercial beverages.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers of speakeasies, and you know, you want it, you can get it anywhere. Continued.
Prohibition goes, the Volstead Act goes into effect in 1920, and within a matter of a year, you had more speakeasies in New York City than you did have legal bars prior to that time. And what was interesting a little later when The New Yorker begins to be published, that there are these huge articles on the speakeasies, the one on near so-and-so is really good for this, and it has really great food, and it's got
so it
this.
So it was out in the open.
It was totally out in the open, and the police, only times that they raided establishments, either because they weren't being paid off by them or because they were required to because of a press attack on them saying they weren't doing their job or somebody irritated somebody else. I mean, it was all sorts of different reasons, but you actually had more illegal establishments for alcohol in Manhattan, for instance, than you did legal establishments prior to Prohibition. And that was something that I was surprised at.
I was watching something which you did a little consulting for, and we're on camera the other night, 101 fast foods that changed the world.
Yeah.
Changed life or whatever.
Saturday night.
Something,
history, yeah.
Yes. Something, it was an interesting show. Fast paced. You got
to
count
down.
The countdown from 101 right. Went, really quickly. But something that surprised me was that when, during Prohibition is when applesauce production went up because they were no longer making hard cider and applesauce suddenly came up into.
Well, that was another part of the story. As I got into it and started writing it, there was nothing that didn't surprise me about the Prohibition period. But one of the things are people were making hard cider, obviously, before Prohibition, and they now can't do that legally. But you can make, by law, it went up and went through the court system, and the Supreme Court accepted it, you could make sweet apple juice, which is one of the places where apple juice will then become an infant beverage that will start at that point. But you could easily convert it into hard apple cider. And so this consumption of all apple products goes sky high in large part because you can then easily convert that into alcoholic beverage or alcoholic product. So,
let's talk about grape juice.
Oh, grape juice is the same thing. And again,
This will start off earlier.
Yeah.
Huge.
Well, no one is commercializing grape juice, and the problem is, as soon as you squeeze the grapes, it starts to ferment, and you have to figure out a way to stop the fermentation. And most people didn't want to stop the fermentation; they want the fermentation to continue. So you really had a problem for those that believed in temperance and didn't believe in alcoholic consumption. So you have the recipes that begin in the 1870s. For Methodist ministers who are in favor of Prohibition, and yet they have religious services and they want people to consume something. And so there's this big religious argument about, what's really in the New Testament isn't wine that they're drinking, it's really unfermented grape juice, and that's what they're... And so you look at these religious arguments that are going on in order to defend their action. So you have recipes then for unfermented wine that begin to appear in the 1870s and will continue on.
And gave rise to one of the Welch's, largest... Yeah,
Welch's grape juice. This starts off because of a minister who really is trying to provide an alternative to alcohol, and as did many of the other products that we think of today as common beverages. Soda will start off as a temperance beverage, and Coca-Cola, which initially did have cocaine in it, called itself the temperance beverage. And so, I mean, it was presenting itself as, and it really starts off as as a drug, and it was to solve headaches. And I suspected that initially cocaine and wine, which was the combination of the two, would mm-hmm. solve a headache. I've never had the two but in combination, but all I can do is say I was surprised that you had alternatives that came along. And the problem with the temperance movement is males got together in bars. That's where males socialized. That's where they met. That's where they engaged in political activity. That's where they learned about what was going on in the world today. Bar of today is not what was like a bar of pre-prohibition period. And there's nothing, if you believe in temperance, if you don't believe in alcoholic consumption, then where do you go? Mm-hmm. And so you had these all sorts of other efforts to create places where people could go, and one of them, of course, is the tea house, mainly for women, but also some men. And then you have the soda fountain.
Soda fountains.
And the soda fountain will start off as a drugstore. I mean, it's druggists that are making this, and for initially for purposes of medicinal solutions and solving problems of one sort or another. And then it will become much more public, and then it becomes a place where teenagers hang out. And 40,000 soda fountains in America during Prohibition, and that's where at least teenagers can go. You didn't have to go to a speakeasy. You could really go to a soda fountain.
Yeah, and too bad they started to die out.
They soda disappeared. There's a few left here and there, but
Well, so you mentioned teenagers could go to a soda fountain. It was a safe place for them to go and gather and hang out. But then in American industry, a big thing that took root where youth beverage, they figured, we want to feed something healthy to the youth, give them things to drink. We had, so sodas came about, and of course milk became, the beverage of choice for parents giving to children. But the youth beverages, you talk about drinks for youths.
And that starts off, that was my hardest chapter to write, and mm-hmm. Because it was so diverse, but it really starts off as saying, if you believe that children should not consume alcohol, and increasingly in the 19th century, this is a concern, and for very good reasons. So it's not just people are religious, and therefore they're not going to, but people looking at this and saying it's not medicinally the right thing to do, and there's lots of medicinal statistics, or lots of statistics that show that people who drank got ill, and people who drank died early, and all sorts of other problems that work and things of that sort. So there was lots of concern on this, and the question is, what do you feed children? At the same time, you have the end of breastfeeding or decrease of breastfeeding for women, and you need to feed them something, and so milk will be the alternative. But milk can only go so far until kids don't rebel against it, but that need flavorings added, and so then you begin to add Bosco. I don't know if you ever had Bosco.
Oh, yeah.
And Hershey's and Nestle and all sorts of other things, flavorings that are added so that kids will drink their milk.
There's even strawberry powder.
Strawberry.
Nesquik.
Yes.
Strawberry.
I consumed that once. but they had chocolate milk, and yeah. I do remember consuming
but
that.
At least
at school.
The base was milk, and then because to go to Kool-Aid, come on. Kool-Aid was huge, a huge business.
But Kool-Aid starts during Prohibition. And so you look at this and saying they're providing an alternative. And it really starts off by an entrepreneur in Hastings, Nebraska, who takes a look at Jell-O and says, Jell-O is such a really great idea. You can package it. You don't have to have a liquid out there. You don't have a bottle. You just put it into a normal package. And so he's looking
at that. And add a lot of sugar.
And add a lot of sugar to it. And therefore, why don't we try to do something like that, not as a solid, but as a beverage? And so that starts off during Prohibition, and it sells extremely well. So you had this huge increase, and that was certainly the beverage of my youth in the 50s.
Absolutely.
You go any place, that would be grape juice. We call it bug juice, but that was what you would normally
that
consume.
That big smiling frosty pitcher,
Yeah, well, that part adds to our culture too. And that's another part of the story. It's just that things that start off as promotional tools end up as popular parts of our culture.
Icons of our culture,
That aren't, the history is the connections are not always there to the early beverages that they had. But that was part of that story, and I thought that was great. Then, of course, to me, it was what my students were drinking today, which was the Red Bull.
Red Bull, right.
And it's the highly caffeinated beverages. And I know some of them claim to have consumed the caffeinated and alcoholic beverages, which are, from a medical standpoint, a disaster. Yeah. So I looked at that and said, well, then, if that's a disaster, what's the difference between people who are drinking at a bar and are told to drink coffee at the end in order to sober them up, and all the coffee will do is put the alcohol into your system much faster and will give you a rush.
A wide awake drunk, you know.
But, yeah, but you know, those are things that I really hadn't given a lot of consideration to.
Yeah. Well, we've actually come a long way in terms of choices of beverages. I mean, to take everyone through, you know, we go through, U.S. becomes a huge producer and consumer of wine, which we don't have time to go into that whole thing, but I think people can understand that. And then, of course, the health craze, conscious of the waters, all the health waters, and now we have smart water. We can drink water that make us smart. I mean, the industry, what you gave some statistics about what of the dollar amount, but it is just amazing, the industry, the entrepreneurs and the economists' projections and the amount of money that is made on trying to satisfy our thirst. And, of course, Starbucks being no slouch as well. I mean, you got that coffee craze in there towards the end.
But Starbucks really, I mean, Starbucks is one of my turning points. And coffee is certainly in America, and it is America's most common beverage up until the 1960s when soda takes over as the number one beverage. But it's generic. I mean, I don't remember if you can. Remember back in the 60s when you'd have a cup of coffee, and if it tasted like dishwater, that would be okay. And if it actually had a little flavor, that would be really great coffee. And Starbucks comes along and creates this premium coffee. You think about this. This starts off in the 1980s, and within a period of 10 years, it becomes not only a national phenomenon, but a global phenomenon.
That's right.
And Starbucks today is the largest chain, restaurant chain in Europe. And you think about that and say, whoa, that's an incredible story in itself. And that's why I thought Howard Schultz and what he did with Starbucks, you know, take it to the level that he did. That's a fascinating story.
It is, and you've managed to pack it all in here, and it's really interesting, a very interesting read. I really I'm happy that you wrote this.
You asked me about periods, and I said there were two, and one was Prohibition.
Yeah,
the other is
that surprised you in your research.
Is the bottled water phenomenon?
Who would have ever thought, right?
The cost of bottled water is anywhere from like 3,000 or 4,000% up to about 10,000% higher than the tap water. And for 99% of Americans, the water that you get out of your tap is perfectly fine.
That's right.
And so the question was, why do people go for the water that they do? And my students, they bring in not just Perrier, but they bring in now volcanic water from Tahiti and glacier water from Iceland. And you're sitting there saying there is no health benefit in that as opposed to just drinking the water out of the fountain at the New School. It's not that different. And look at what you're doing in order to the environment by producing all this
plastic and glass
that's thrown out. And so several of them say, oh, no, we just bought one bottle and now we just fill it up with water from tap just to make us look good.
And it's a fashion statement.
It's an image statement.
Yeah, image statement.
And that's the same thing. I run in Prospect Park and there's so many people that have their technical bottle of water, and I just really wonder whether it's real stuff in there or whether they just put in their tap water before they left to make them look good. But I guess what's the difference on fashion statements?
It would make them a lot smarter to read your book than to drink smart water.
Oh, that's exactly what I tell them. I said, oh, you're much smarter if you read this. So,
well, Andy, it has been a real pleasure. As always, we could go on and on and on, but pizza awaits us from Roberta's restaurant. So
I was hoping you'd mention that.
I think we're going to have to take a break from drinking and do some eating, and I hope you'll come back and share more of your information. You've always got so much to talk about. And I thank you for listening. And once again, Andy Smith's book is called Drinking History, 15 Turning Points in the Making of American Beverages. And you can find more information out about Andy at his website, andrewfsmith.com. And I hope you'll join me again here on A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.